I'm Valence, and I'm coming to you from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as the moderator for our live broadcast. Today's seminar will look at CEC training for OSCs. This is our series on oil spill response. Today's seminar will cover part two in a two-part series on that particular topic. If you need the link to replay part one, which was delivered yesterday, please use the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen, where you should see welcome messages for me, and I'll be happy to get that URL out. We are encouraging everyone to take the parts sequentially. So if you need to use this 3 hours to replay part one, and we'll get you a link for part two right after our live delivery today, please let us know that's the case, and we'll get you the correct information. For just another moment, I'm going to leave our starting screen up that has some basic information about our session, as well as an interactive poll letting everybody know a little bit about the participants who are joining us today. For those of you that may have not participated live and you're not quite sure what to do in order to join us for the broadcast here for part two, I'm going to refer you back to an email that you would have received when you signed up for today's webinar. That email would have had a complete set of instructions on how to join us, specifically pointing you to something called the Clue-In Seminar homepage, where you could have read about the events, found contact information for our presenters, links to download the slides, options to provide feedback, but most importantly, in the upper left corner, a button that says Go to Seminar, which will allow you to check yourself in online and join us in our fully interactive Adobe Connect room. Once you come into that Adobe Connect room, you're going to see a whole bunch of boxes and windows, and we're kicking things off with a little bit of an interactive component. So if you haven't done so already, go ahead and look in the lower half of your screen in the Adobe Connect room. You'll see two interactive polls. We're testing this approach to kicking things off. We've got a question on the left. If you need to vote on that, simply click the circle to the left of the answer that best meets your reply, asking how many years of experience in oil spill response do you have. Right now, we do have about 80 individuals who have joined us live. That number continues to creep up. And of those 80 individuals who have hopped on the line, it looks like just under half of them are brand new to oil spill response with less than 3 years of experience. About 13% of you have about 3 to 10 years, and then about a third of the audience has 10 or more. And then the rest of the group here, about 13%, have no experience in the oil spill response area. The question to the right of that asks about our organizational background for our participants. We do have a nice mixture for today. It looks like we have about 20% of the audience is coming in from EPA regional offices. About a third of you are coming in from state, local, or tribal organizations. 16% are representing other federal agencies. A quarter of the audience is coming from the private sector, and then the remainders are either international participants or coming from other groups. So we do appreciate everybody sharing a little bit of a background about themselves that our presenters and let me go ahead and get up these starting slides so I can turn things over to our presenters. Again, our whole session is going to be offered live through Adobe Connect. You can actually see and hear everything right through your computer or mobile device. If you're having any problems, though, with Adobe Connect, you can download the slides and simply follow along on the phone if needed, but we do encourage you to try to join us live for the full interactive experience. Online audio is going to be available for every one of our participants. You can use your computer speakers or headphones to participate that way. If you have any problems with the online audio, check your local volume settings. You might need to simply turn your speakers up. If that continues to be a problem, though, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Simply use the Q&A window in the lower right corner to go ahead and request that, and I'll be more than happy to share the call-in information with anyone who needs it. We will have everyone on the telephone lines globally muted, and we ask that you remain globally muted to help cut down on other audio disruptions and background noises. We will take question and answer breaks throughout today's session, and in order to submit a comment or question, I'm going to draw your attention to the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. You can type up your comments and questions at any time. In fact, I encourage you to do that as soon as they occur to you, and then when we get to those designated breaks, I will read them out loud on your behalf to the presenters for a response. If you have any technical problems, you can also use the Q&A window to report them there. Today's session is being recorded and will be available for free replay and download from the Clue-In website. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to get those archives up. And since this is the second part, though, in a series of sessions, I'm going to email out an early link to playback online to everyone who registered so that if you signed up for either one of the two parts, you guys will be able to complete that. But within 1 week, we should have the full complete archive for both sessions posted to the Clue-In website so that anyone who visits can actually download them and replay them. If you want to take a look, feel free to browse the nearly 500 archive sessions that we currently have available on the Clue-In website. So you should see the majority of your screen is dedicated to the PowerPoint presentations we'll be covering today. If you want to make that window bigger, you can use the full screen button that appears in the upper right corner of that particular window. Click it once to make the slides larger. If you want to take them back down to their normal size so you can see the other windows, simply press full screen again. You can go in and out of full screen as needed. You'll see our Clue-in logo and a collection of related URLs on the right. But I want to draw your attention to that Q&A window where you can type up your comments and questions here in the lower white box or field at the bottom and press the little cartoon bubble to the right to submit them. Feel free to test that functionality out at any time as needed. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for today's session, so I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our two starting instructors today, Earl Liverman and Jim Mullins. Feel free to kick things off, gentlemen.
Thank you, Jean, and on behalf of Jim and I, good morning to everyone and welcome, and we look forward to having a good session today. As is just about the case with everything, we need to provide a disclaimer. And that disclaimer is that the purpose of this presentation is to stimulate thought and discussion. And most importantly, nothing in this presentation is intended to supersede or contravene federal statutes, regulations, or official EPA policy. All of us are going to do the best to share with you what we know about things, but please keep in mind occasionally a mistake is made. And I've discovered of late, as I get older, I forget things on occasion. So with respect to me, I'm in beautiful North Idaho, in Coeur d'Alene in particular, and I've been out here for a number of years, involved both with EPA's remedial and emergency response programs. Greg Weigel, who is not on the line at this time, but will be joining us in a short while, is also stationed in Idaho. He's in downstate Idaho in Boise, and he has similarly served as an OSC for almost two decades. We're very fortunate to have Doug Kadama as well. However, he will not be joining us until later on, a considerable amount of time. And then we're very fortunate to have Jim Mullins, the sage elder, if you will, who has a wealth of experience out of Region 6 in Dallas, Texas. And so we're very pleased to have him with us, and I wouldn't be surprised if on one or two occasions he doesn't grab my tail and says, Earl, you might want to think about this. All right, so let's get started. We've gone through this. Instructors, Jean has also provided some insight as to the wealth and diversity of participants, and thank you. We're very pleased. I'd like to go over the course overview very quickly. What you see are those topics that we covered yesterday, and you know those dealt with a lot of conceptual notions, and just to make sure everyone had a shared background and understanding. Today, on the other hand, we're going to look more at the operational aspects of oil spill response. And there will be some redundancy in subject matter, but it's only so as to emphasize particular issues that are important and that should all be walkaways for everyone. Okay, this is just a brief overview of what we did yesterday. This is an overview of what we intend to do today, statutory and regulatory authority, oil spill management, oil spill response techniques, disposal of oil and oily debris, and then a closing statement. All right, are there any questions at this point before we begin? I'll take that as a no, so let's get started. The purpose of this module is to better understand the statutory and regulatory authority for responding to an oil spill. And again, some of this is a review of important information presented yesterday. We spent a considerable amount of time speaking about the Clean Water Act, the Executive Order 12777, but I don't believe we mentioned anything about the National Response Framework. And in a nutshell, this is a guide as to how the nation conducts all hazard responses. It provides for a tiered response that is both scalable and flexible and adaptable to the operational scenario that you're dealing with. And it provides for a unity of effort through unified command, which we'll talk about later on. And then, of course, most of you, or all of you, I hope, will recall that the NCP is the nation's blueprint for responding to discharges of oil and releases of hazardous substances. I'd also like to remind you that there is a threshold that influences EPA's and the Coast Guard's ability to respond. We've covered all of these items yesterday. But the fourth item, I don't believe we spent much time talking about. What does it mean for removal actions to be consistent with the NCP? And I'd like to spend a few moments just covering that. What it means is that there are certain things that the OFC can do in order to respond. And that includes analyzing water samples to determine the source and spread of the oil, controlling the source of discharge, measuring and sampling, source and spread control or salvage operations. For example, there might be a vessel, both in coastal and inland waters, the placement of physical barriers to deter the spread of the oil and to protect natural resources and sensitive ecosystems. We'll talk about this later on today. Disposal of oil and oily debris, which is also a topic that we will talk about later on today. Control of the water discharged from an upstream impoundment, and the use of chemicals and other materials in accordance with subpart J to the NCP to restrain the spread of the oil and mitigate its effects. Now, this next slide presents a topic that is very challenging for all of us. And just exactly what does it mean when a person says waters of the U.S.? A greater discussion of this can be found in 40 CFR 230.3. But generally, what traditional navigable waters means are those waters that are currently used or were used in the past or may be susceptible to use in interstate or foreign commerce. And this notion of interstate or foreign commerce is very broad. It also takes into consideration those areas that could be used for recreational or other purposes, or from which fish or shellfish could be taken and sold in interstate or foreign commerce, or which could be used for industrial purposes by industries. It also includes wetlands that are adjacent to traditional navigable waters, non-navigable waters that at least have some amount of year-round or partial flow, intermittent flow, for some reasonable period of time, and then wetlands that directly abut such tributaries. But as you can well imagine, it's never as simple as it sounds. There are those non-navigable tributaries that may not be relatively permanent, that may still fall within the scope of waters of the U.S. And what we do in these instances is there is a fact-specific analysis that would have to be conducted to demonstrate whether or not there is a significant nexus. This is something that is done both from a programmatic perspective involving the OSC and others, as well as a legal involvement to help you interpret not only the statute itself, but can bring about to bear a legal perspective on those site-specific conditions that you think lead to the designation of a particular water feature as waters of the U.S. The type of features that you see here, while at one time may have been considered, and now under certain circumstances could still be considered, but require special consideration and caution, are swales and erosional features, or ditches excavated wholly in or draining only uplands and that do not carry a relatively permanent flow. Where this might become particularly challenging nowadays is where you start to see infiltration swales and things of that nature that are a means for controlling surface waters. If those types of features have but a dry well, for example, or some sort of infiltration gallery that is not interconnected with some other drainage feature or whatnot, but is relatively speaking contained, arguably those are not the type of features that would fall within the waters of the U.S. However, don't limit your analysis of these types of features to the immediate proximity of these features. Take the time to walk the landscape to get a better understanding of what's going on, because you might find but a few hundred feet downstream there is suddenly some sort of a surface water drainage feature that you might otherwise have been not been aware of, and but does provide that nexus for leading to some sort of feature, a creek or a small stream, onto a lake, or onto a larger river, and so on and so forth. So take the time to do a thorough analysis in making your determination as to whether or not you're involved with surface waters of the U.S. Now, some other things that the OSC must do with respect to the discharge is that he or she must officially classify the size as either minor, medium, or major, and the type, substantial threat, or worst-case discharge. So, for example, a minor, and these definitions are found in the NCP at 300.5, a minor is 1,000 gallons to inland or less than 10,000 to coastal areas. Medium inland is 1 to 10,000 gallons, whereas coastal is 10,000 to 100,000. And then major for inland is 10,000 and coastal is 100,000. I would encourage you, though, to look at this from a regional perspective, and EPA regions throughout the country have different views with respect to these differing quantities. So, for example, in Region 10, which is Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, depending upon the circumstances, it would not be unusual for us to deploy an OSC to a spill that might be 10 gallons in size, or it might be 100. Role of trustees and their interests, and just the general sensitivity, if you will, towards incidents of this nature in the Pacific or the inland Northwest. And Jim, would you like to offer a perspective on these quantities from Region 6?
No, I think there are definitely differences about how people feel about significant quantities of oil. In the oil-producing parts of this country, the quantity is usually a little higher than in the non-oil-producing parts. Earl, being from the Pacific Northwest, comes to Texas sometimes and sees an oil spill that is not yawned at, but it's not a high priority as it would be if it were the same spill were in the Pacific Northwest.
Okay, thank you, Jim. We're going to talk about substantial threat here in a few moments, but let's move on to worst-case discharges. And, you know, what this means is the largest foreseeable discharge in adverse weather conditions. And for a vessel, it's a discharge in adverse weather conditions of its entire cargo. And then you have spills of national significance. These are those discharges that are classified as a substantial threat to public health or welfare of the United States, and that are classified as such by the administrator of EPA. And the factors that he or she would consider in making this determination are very similar to what you would consider when making a determination about size, and they include such things as the severity of the discharge, the size and the location, the actual or potential impact on public health or welfare and the environment, or the necessary response complex could be response effort could be so complex as to require extraordinary coordination of resources. And you know, recall the other day we mentioned that dependent upon the size, you might have multi-agency and multi-jurisdiction responses. And so, for example, there in the BP response, as you can well imagine, you had both national, state, and local entities, and that was clearly an incident that rose to this standard. Okay, substantial threat determination. We're going to spend a few slides discussing this matter. The OSC makes the determination of a substantial threat. It is not discretionary. Along with public health and welfare, the OSC should also consider fish, shellfish, wildlife, other natural resources, and public and private beaches. And then with respect to documentation, one of the things you should always remember to do, particularly in this era when things are becoming increasingly litigious, decisions are being made by different entities and courts, seemingly have the impact of changing the landscape overnight, you should always remember to document those factors that you've considered in making this determination, which again includes but are not limited to the size of the discharge, the character of the discharge, and the nature of the threat to public health or welfare of the United States. All right, substantial threat. I wish I could tell you that there is a single definition that you could go to, but there is not. Rather, there are discussions about substantial threat that are found in different documents. So, for example, this document, 30 CFR 154, that is for facilities transferring oil or hazardous material in bulk. In particular, this is a regulation that applies to facilities that are capable of transferring oil or hazardous materials to or from a vessel that has a particular capacity. And so what you see here is any incident or condition involving a facility that may create a risk of discharge of oil. That's all it says. Another place that you might be able to find some insight is in 40 CFR Part 112, which is a regulation affecting oil pollution prevention related onshore or offshore shore facilities. And here you find a definition that goes to location, which could reasonably be expected to discharge oil in quantities that might be harmful, as described in Part 110. And I trust you'll recall that 40 CFR Part 110, as we discussed yesterday, is the discharge of oil regulation, or the Sheen rule, if you will. And the criteria for the applicability is that discharges that cause a sheen or a discoloration on the surface of a body of water, or discharges that violate water quality standards. So it's very difficult to find a concrete definition as to what substantial threat means. There's many sources that you can go out there and consult along with others in your program and in your staff attorneys as well in reaching this determination. So that's all that I have for this brief module. Are there any questions before we proceed to the next?
We did have a question that came in online already, but for those of you that have not submitted one, you can use that Q&A window in the lower right corner to type them up at any point. While we're waiting to see if anybody else has a question, let me read off the first one that came in. One of our participants would like to know what is considered or the definition of navigable waterway. Is it something that you're able to float a canoe on, or is it something else?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'll certainly ask for Jim's help along this line, but you'll recall that the brief definition that I provided is that waters that are currently used, were used in the past, or may be susceptible to use in interstate or foreign commerce. Certainly, canoes and other type of watercraft at one time were used in commerce. And from a more current perspective, waters that can be used for recreational purposes or from which fish or shellfish could be taken and sold in interstate or foreign commerce could also fall into the scope of waters of the U.S. So my response would be, yes, they could be. However, again, this is something you would want to think a little bit more about. Make sure it passes the laugh test. Jim?
Exactly right. And usually that there's an additional group of waters and adjacent wetlands around the body of water, which Earl just described, namely the first tributaries to those waters of the U.S. and the adjacent wetlands. So all of that can fall into the regulated regulation.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, we do have another question that came in, and one participant wants to know, what was the CFR reference for navigable waterways?
That reference is 40 CFR 230.3.
Okay, and we do have another participant, though, that has just a comment or another question based off of your previous statement about navigable waterways. One of our participants wants to know, aren't there limits to waters of the U.S. based on court decisions?
And the answer to that is yes. This is a very dynamic field that is frequently interpreted by the courts, and in particular the Supreme Court. And there is one recent decision that's referred to as the Sackett decision, and it involves a particular issue in North Idaho up towards the border. And while I don't recall the specifics of that decision, it illustrates the fact that it is a very dynamic field, both with the respect to the interpretation as to what this means, but also what the consequences of the judicial rulings are for EPA. And if I recall correctly, in this particular case, the court's rendering now allows for pre-decision review, or let's see, how did I think it has something to do with the opportunity to review EPA decisions before those decisions are made final by EPA. In other words, it's pre versus post review. And from a practical perspective, what the OSC now has to be concerned with is his or her record. For CERCLA, there are certain things that we have to do with respect to development of an administrative record to ensure that all of those decision documents and various facts and issues that we rely on with respect to our decision to take a particular action are well documented. And there wasn't as necessarily the same requirement for clean water type actions. Oil response actions. And now as a consequence of Sackett and others, we have to be much, much more concerned with how we document our decisions, the type of records we create, and so on and so forth. And so the answer is yes, there are court decisions, there are recent decisions, and we in all likelihood can anticipate future challenges.
It's very dynamic, and you should probably seek legal counsel on that. You know, if you have questions about whether you are or are not in waters of the U.S., this is not a real big problem if you're in the Mississippi or the Ohio or the Tennessee River. It's a big problem when you get into some of the really, really small ephemeral tributaries to those same streams.
Okay, we had one participant who would like to know if you could repeat the name or the details of that Idaho case.
Okay, I don't know the exact name of the proceeding, but the party's name is Sackett, S-A-C-K-E-T-T. And if you were to Google that, something such as EPA Sackett decision or Supreme Court Sackett decision, you would be able to find the case and a wealth of commentary on the ruling of the court.
Okay, great. I think that's the end of the online questions I see submitted. Participants can continue to share your comments and questions as we go on, but let's move on to slide number 25 with about 2.5 hours left for our seminar.
All right, and again, thank you, Jean. Okay, we're now going to talk about oil spill management, and Greg Weigel, another instructor, has joined us, so you now have three of us. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you,
Earl. The purpose of this module is to better understand the main tasks that an OSC is responsible for during an oil spill response. And let's start with the very beginning. There are priorities that are presented in the NCP. So if at any time you're involved in incident command or unified to start, safety of human life, including any search and rescue efforts in the general proximity of the discharge, and safety of response personnel. First and foremost, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You want to send everyone home with what they came with. Stabilize the situation to prevent the event from worsening. Ensure timely and effective response. And then there's also a fourth category, which is what people oftentimes will immediately default to, and that's other priorities on a site-specific basis. And this is where you have the opportunity to insert incident-specific objectives, such as the protection of certain natural, cultural, or historic features, specific operational period objectives, and the like. There is a general pattern of response that's also laid out in the NCP. With respect to item one, it's important to direct response actions and to coordinate all other efforts. Item two emphasizes partnership. You're not there alone. Typically, you have unified command where you'll find other major stakeholders, part of the command structure. You have resources within your command, and then you also have external resources, supporting and cooperating agencies that are on the fringe who might be able to assist in certain ways. And then what's intended by the third task is to emphasize a broad diversity of tasks that the OSC is responsible for. It's just not one thing. And it's many things that happen simultaneously. Did someone have a comment there that I may have spoken over? Okay. Let's move on to the next slide. The NCP delineates four phases of response for oil spill operations. These may run sequentially, or they may run concurrently, depending upon the magnitude or the complexity of the incident, and we're going to talk about all of these a little bit more in the following slides. But you'll note, as I mentioned, the OSC has to evaluate the size and the nature of spill and potential hazards. This might include efforts that occur over the phone during the first notification through the NRC. Within the state of Idaho, we have what's referred to as bridge calls, or state comm calls. These are telephone calls that can be initiated by just about anyone. Typically, they are by incident commanders. And in Idaho, those incident commanders, at least initially, are more often than not your first responders, such as fire and law enforcement. And it's an opportunity to share information, to gain immediate insight as to what the nature of the incident is, and to begin to share information back and forth as you develop your response. The environmental considerations include the type of oil spilled. Is it lighter or heavier? And we all learned how important that was yesterday with respect to the response and how quick you might have to get there and how you could deploy resources. Is the discharge to standing water Is it slow-moving water, or is it fast-moving water? In Idaho, and Greg, I'd ask you to chime in at any time, please, since you're up here with me. Many of our streams are fast water at remote locations, and so by the time people have received notice of a release, it could take us anywhere from 3 to 6 to 8 hours to get there. Well, in that amount of time, the product has been pushed downstream, and how you would prioritize or determine the criticality of your response could be significantly different as a consequence of that. You may be thinking 30 miles, 40 miles, 50 miles downstream, not 1 or 2 miles from the release, given the amount of time that you have to get there. So those types of features are important. Is the habitat freshwater or marine? And what is the type and sensitivity of biological communities? Yesterday, Greg mentioned that many of our waters, particularly the Clearwater and the Locksaw, which is a trip to the Clearwater, have threatened and endangered species, Chinook salmon, steelhead, but then also many of these streams are federally designated wild and scenic rivers. And it's not uncommon to have an incident occur on a stream that's both wild and scenic for many and different purposes, or for which there are federally threatened and endangered species, critical habitat, or state concerns. Okay, and then from operational period need with respect to item two, other considerations are, has the responsible party been identified, and can the PRP handle the incident? Remember, EPA has an enforcement first policy, which is to say we like to see the ERP commit their resources before we do, but if in the event the ERP is not, it's not appropriate for the ERP to do so, then we have our means to fund responses both through the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund and the Super Fund, depending upon the type of material that's lost. Are there other local, state, and or tribal authorities that can manage the incident? And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the ways in which OSCs can both provide oversight or management of a discharge as well as fund. And then has the discharge been stopped? In other words, is it ongoing or has it been stopped? And then there's other ways that, you know, you can group this. This is just one perspective. You might be able to group these tasks as assessment, monitoring, response assistance, reporting, and planning if you desire. But for the purposes of this instruction, we're going to look at it a little bit differently. Okay, the response management framework at different times, we have referred to incident command or unified command and the like. And the National Incident Management System, as I mentioned earlier, is flexible, it's modular, both of which facilitate scalability. And what this is just a long way of saying that whatever structure is set up can be adopted to the scale, or rather adapted to the scale of the incident. It might be 3 people, it might be 3,000 people, depending upon the type of the incident. And it's standardized so as to improve integration and connectivity. And what that means is this framework, if you will, could be overlaid any incident. It doesn't matter whether it's 3 or 3,000. And the beauty of that is that people who have been trained in this can walk in and immediately understand how things are laid out, where they are, and the overall hierarchy of the incident response structure and the like. It's amazing how easy you can come in and out without any real knowledge of who you're working with, but for your training and what your roles and responsibilities are with respect to the overall incident. Now, oftentimes this diagram depicts what is the case, and that is where you might have a single incident commander. And typically what influences that is that if you have a single jurisdiction and there is no jurisdictional or functional agency overlap between the federal, state, local, tribal, and the like. But unified command, which we're finding is increasingly more the case, is where you would have two, perhaps three or more people within incident command who represent federal, state, and tribal, or federal, state, and the responsible party as the three entities who are managing the overall response. And again, the particular structure that you might have is situationally dependent. Now, what this diagram shows is a structure that you might see that would be commonly associated with an oil spill response incident. And there's a couple of things here that are unique. The blue boxes that you see are very common. You have an incident commander. You may have one or two deputy incident commanders. Why? Because the incident commander is focused on the overall response, and if you were to have a deputy, he or she could assign that deputy to do certain things in support of his efforts. You have the command staff. You may also have a legal officer, and that's because there might be certain issues that, such as you have a number of potential claimants that feel they have been injured, or there just might be thorny issues that are out there that you need to have a legal officer, perhaps if only to balance the fact that the RP might bring a legal officer in there as well. And then you might also find what's referred to as a business interruption chief or some similar title. And what this is that this is a position wherein a person would identify, contact, and consult with all internal and external groups whose businesses may have been impacted by the incident and the like. So this is a very unique role. And then beneath these various section levels, you could have your branches, your divisions, your groups, your single resource or strike teams or task forces, all of those things that are influenced by the specific response that you're dealing with. But some of the unique ones for oil is a legal officer, again, as well as a business interruption chief or something similar to that. Another operational consideration is, as we've mentioned earlier, identify your PRPs early on. And recall it's important to do so because it helps to preserve the oil spill liability trust fund for other activities, and it just gets them in. Administrative orders, perhaps you've heard 311Cs bantered around, 311Ds. I believe Greg mentioned yesterday that in all of his time with EPA, he's perhaps been involved with only one. Likewise, I've been only involved with only one. And as Greg noted, it was more for political than practical reasons. A 311C order is an order that responds to discharges or threatened discharges. Some of the other things that we're concerned about that were also mentioned the other day is one of the first things that we typically do when we respond is we provide a notice of federal instant interest, or NOSI. And this is just telling the RP that the United States has an interest in a particular incident and what the OSC's role is with respect to that. Now, a Notice of Federal Assumption, or a NOFA, is that document that's provided to the RP if in the event they are improperly carrying out the action or unwilling to carry out the action, and then the OSC assumes responsibility for the cleanup. And the RP remains liable for cost incurred by the federal government. I've only had one experience with this. It was a number of years ago, and it was when the RP just sort of threw his hands up in the air and said, look, I don't know what to do. I want you to take over for me. And so we provided a NOFA. And as part of both of these notices, you include such things as the location and the time of discharge, notice that the person is suspect, is the suspected source, reference to the Clean Water Act and the federal government's role, cleanup role, notice that the person or the responsible party, if you will, is possibly financially responsible to the to the federal government and the like. Okay, some other important issues with respect to the operation of a cleanup. One that is oftentimes forgotten is access. That's both private access and public access. And this is very, very important with respect to the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution. I know of a number of people who will share with you their horror stories about having not obtained consent for access in the proper way, only to be held accountable for that by people whose property they trespassed on for years and years and years. So this is one of the things to keep in mind. Work with your legal staff. Obtain the necessary consent for access. Do so also with public lands, because all public lands in some way, shape, or form have an administering agency. You should contact them, make sure they understand why you were there, what the purpose is, so on and so forth. Along with access, there are also contracts that an OSC can access to assist with cleanup. There's what's referred to as our START contractor, which is our Superfund Technical Assessment and Response Team. These are our engineers, if you will, our scientists, consultants. They're the ones that will show up with instrumentation and so on and so forth to assist with the overall response. ERS, which are our Emergency and Rapid Response Services contractors, are the men and women who operate the equipment. They're the ones who are actually out there on the ground operating equipment, handling shovels, placing booms, so on and so forth. Then we also have the PURFIS, which Greg spoke about yesterday, and that is a tool that's available to obtain local services, perhaps in a more prompt way than would otherwise be available for our START or ERS contractors, or that might prove to be more cost-effective and efficient, because as you can well imagine, when we mobilize our resources to an incident, particularly over great distances, it's not cheap. Federal oversight, as I mentioned earlier, monitoring can be conducted from the site when necessary or from an agency if the situation appears to be under control or from a remote location. So, for example, if there were to be an incident 6 or 7 hours away from here, at some point in time, it's just not reasonable for Greg or myself or some other EPA OSC to remain on site at all times. And that responsibility could then be transferred to another agency, such as a state agency. Or if the RP were to remain in charge of or were to continue to conduct the cleanup activities, you may be able to provide adequate oversight or team with your state counterpart to provide adequate oversight from a remote distance. In other words, you might show up every 2 days, or you might show up every 3 days, or something of that nature. With respect to federal oversight versus federal takeover, we like to work with federal oversight, provided that the RP is taking action that is timely. In other words, there aren't different delays due to getting the right type of equipment on site and so on and so forth. And Greg will talk about those various equipment types and techniques and whatnot later on, that they're technically appropriate. At some of these locations, remote locations in years past, it's not uncommon to find anyone who has a used dump truck or a used Bobcat to feel that they're well equipped to enter into the spill response business. Well, that may or may not be technically appropriate, so you'll want to make sure that whatever resources that are deployed are appropriate, both with respect to the need for equipment, but also to the training of personnel. And then you'll also want to make sure that whatever actions that are being taken are consistent with state and regulations. Response assistance. There may be instances where we need to bring in external assistance to complement the RP or to otherwise do the work ourselves. And as we briefly, well, as we talked about at great length yesterday, there is the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. But then there's other things that I don't believe we mentioned, such as the national and regional response teams, special forces teams that EPA has available. And then again, please don't forget federal agencies. There are a number of federal agencies that are specifically called out by the NCP who could provide assistance dependent upon land ownership, the type of product spills, and the likes. We also mentioned state and local participation that is available. And non-governmental participation. A question was raised yesterday, I believe, about the use of volunteers. And it just so happens that in 2012, the National Response Team developed a guidance document titled Use of Volunteers Guidelines for Oil Spills. This document was prepared in response to the many recent incidents that, because of their sheer size, there was an outpouring of the community, a strong desire to want to go out there and help to perhaps recover oiled wildlife, or maybe nothing more complicated than picking up oiled debris. Well, as you can well imagine, there are issues that are associated with that, and they include such things as liability issues, health and safety training, and funding. So this is a new document, hasn't been out there long, and it's a great source of information if you ever encounter a volunteer group or are perhaps a volunteer yourself outside of your official capacities. Again, this is review. There are federal trustees, there are state trustees, and there are tribal trustees that are available to assist. Another major area that you have to be concerned with is public information and community relations. And as you can see here, the type of contact that you might have with the public, and I suspect we've all had this at one time or the other, might be a standing before a camera talking with local television stations. It might be providing a more formal briefing to a group that perhaps has assembled on site. Or it could be this. It could be the auditorium full of people. And we've had it all. And but the point is that depending upon your incident, you could encounter any one of these scenarios. And there are resources that are available to you. Whether it be through the JIC, a Joint Information Center, which is an umbrella under which the different federal, state, and local agencies coordinate their outreach efforts to ensure that there's transparency and that the same message is being sent. Coming out of the command, typically the incident commander will approve all press releases and things of that nature. So there are resources out there to help you in that regard. Worker health and safety. It's paramount, as I said earlier. You want everyone to go home and with all that they came with and in good health. And the NCP is very clear that the FOSC is responsible for addressing worker health and safety. They're not directly responsible in that we are not taking responsibility for what is otherwise required by OSHA, the Occupational Safe and Health Act, which is 29 CFR, but rather our role is to ensure that the OSHA requirements are in fact being implemented on our particular sites through site-specific or incident-specific health and safety plan. And these two photographs are intended to give you a sense as to what those, the range of health and safety issues might be. You'll note on the left-hand side is what you've got here is a booming action, and you'll see the use of PFDs or personal flotation devices and hard hats. So that's one scenario. And the scenario on the right is a little bit different. You see people in Tyvek, you see people without hard hats, you see people without PFDs. In this instance, the incident commander or unified command working with the health and safety officer determined that the Tyvek suits and the boots and whatnot were appropriate for that particular incident. However, on the left, you see other PPE, or personal protective equipment. So it can vary considerably with whatever your response is. Okay, documentation and reporting. This is an ongoing activity that happens literally from the moment you receive the call, making the decision to respond in concert with others, to the conduct of the response itself, and then to closing everything out. Remember, if it's a irrespective of whether it's an RP or a fund lead or a funded action, cost recovery is always going to be an issue. If it's a PRP lead, EPA or the Coast Guard will attempt to recover costs incidental to the staff time or the mobilization of resources that may have occurred early on. Likewise, the fund, the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, will seek to cost recover those monies that were advanced to the OSC, and so the OSC is going to want to make sure that they can provide an adequate cost recovery package so that the fund can move forward. It's very important to maintain a historical record of your decisions, when you made those decisions, upon which reasons did you make the decisions, and the like. There's also a requirement for poll reps or sit reps. I believe Greg spent a brief time talking about that yesterday. The NCP requires OSC to submit these types of reports and to the regional response team and other appropriate agencies. So for example, when we prepare poll reps, which are typically at the initiation and completion of an action, and there may be intermediate ones as well, we use it as a means of communication both internally and externally to make sure that everyone knows what's going on and the like. And they also serve as the primary or an important record, if you will, of actions, notifications, decisions, and the like that are made. So it's one means of memorializing your actions that would then be supported by logbooks or other means of keeping records that might be available. Okay, once again, we've gone over this before. Very quick review. And I would like to ask you, do you believe that these criteria are absolute? And I hope you will say no. They're not absolute. They're a threshold at which we begin to determine whether or not EPA or other agencies need to get involved. Okay, cleanup endpoints. Very, very important. When you are in the process of responding to a discharge of oil, one of the things that you should be considering along with everything else is, what is my exit strategy? How am I going to get out of here? And endpoints, or how clean is clean, is a means for helping you do that. endpoints can be qualitative, which means that they're based primarily on observation, visual observation, or smell, if you will, or touch, and do not necessarily require the collection of any type of data. On the other hand, they could be quantitative, which is to say you rely on data, surface water quality data, product data, and the like. And this can be very challenging. And so Jim or Greg, Jim in particular, would you like to comment on this notion of state standards, particularly with respect to Texas, which I think has some widely varying TPH standards?
Yeah, there are huge variations, are there? At least there are in Region 6. That's the Texas and the states that touch it, and that encompasses a lot of the oil-producing part of the country. Certainly not all of it. There's, I think, production in about 40 states. Long story short, the cleanup endpoints vary from location to location, so it's really important that you make sure you understand who you're working with and what, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans. You need to make sure you know what's going on in your location.
Well, that's absolutely right, and it's location not only from a jurisdictional perspective, but also from just a physical perspective as to the type of shoreline and beaches that might be impacted. So, for example, you might have an incident where you have multiple endpoints along a given reach of stream, for example, that's been impacted by a discharge. And those endpoints would be influenced by such things as vegetation, shoreline characteristics, water intakes, state requirements, and the likes. So thank you.
Earl, this is Greg.
Yeah.
Just to emphasize even more what you said about endpoints, frequently when we go to an emergency response or a drill, the emphasis is getting boom out there quickly. And when we bring up endpoints as well, we can deal with that later. You know, we need to get boom out. But we've seen time and time again that if you don't identify your endpoints very early or up front, it leads to so much confusion. You know, I think we've seen that in maybe the Yellowstone River or the Silvertip Pipeline response, where it was unclear what we were trying to achieve and whether that, you know, in terms of mitigating at the very end what should be a discharge or potential discharge to waters of the U.S. and whether those activities were all directed to that end. So,
yeah, excellent point, and thank you, Greg. To give you a little more insight into this, in a ICS structure, if it's large enough, you're going to have what's referred to as an environmental unit. And one of the responsibilities of that environmental unit is to assist the incident command in the development of endpoints. But more importantly, it's as a result of developing those endpoints that you then have the environmental unit leader who's in the planning section communicating with the operations section. In other words, that environmental section is telling operations not only what their goals or objectives are, but then they're also recommending response techniques. Now, it's not that they're telling ops what to do, but they're at least giving ops some guidance. And as Greg mentioned early on, that's crucial so that people are not out there just floundering, putting out booms, throwing pads, and the like.
Thanks,
okay,
sir.
Some example of qualitative inputs: you can't smell it anymore, or you can't see it anymore, or, you know, you're looking at the quality of the sheen, or further actions would cause more harm than good, or cleanup measures would be excessively costly in view of their overall contribution to cleanup. And this particular endpoint for me has been very, very problematic in dealing with remote sites and different stakeholders. But all of these could be very challenging in and of themselves at any given time. Quantitative endpoints, you get a background, you get what's happening during your incident, you collect data, you look at predetermined concentrations. For example, this might come surface water quality from the state and the likes. Okay, some of the issues that affect the selection of endpoints. Type in the amount of oil spilled. Remember, if it's heavy, it does certain things. If it's light, such as gasoline or diesel, it might do certain things. And the type of shoreline, the value of the habitat or the use of the segment, and the timing of that use, and so on and so forth. It can range from a relatively simple one to one that is difficult and complex and involves several rounds of negotiations. And these negotiations are with stakeholders, other federal, state, local stakeholders. For example, when we responded to an incident, well, Greg, you should tell this story. It was one of your responses in working with the Forest Service and the replacement of riprap along a segment of the river. I'm not sure if it was in the wild and scenic corridor, but perhaps you could describe that as an endpoint from a federal stakeholder. Do you recall?
Oh, yeah, it was within the wild and scenic corridor there, and it was a tank truck spill on the bank of the river. We had to tear out the bank. The bank was riprapped, and so all the riprap was oiled, and we, I guess, could have cleaned it off and put it back in, but instead identified another source for equivalent riprap and installed that. And the Forest Service, after we had put that in, was very unhappy because the new riprap didn't match in terms of color and texture, I guess, even though it was adequately sized, didn't match what was there before, what was on either side of it. And felt that detracted from the wild and scenic river and the visual quality of it. So that was a problem. We had to decide whether we were going to take it out and replace it or not, and decided not to. And that's something that they remembered for a long time, and I think still remember.
Yes, and in fact, I had an incident a year or two after Greg's upstream, and one of the first things we had to address with the Forest Service so as to not offend the aesthetic sensibilities of rafters and whatnot on the river was that any riprap removed would be cleaned and put back in as close to its original condition and its original location as is possible. Go ahead, please.
So, you know, there are things that you don't think about unless you've had these experiences. You know, we didn't even think about the riprap, but it came back to bite us. And if you're not reaching out and doing, you know, all of that consultation, trustee consultation, making sure they're engaged, you're likely to miss something.
Thank you. All right, the last bullet item on this is perceptions of risk and regional differences, and we just want to make the point, as we briefly discussed earlier, different regions have different perceptions of risk. While Region 6 would think nothing of not doing anything in response to a 1,000-gallon oil spill, in Region 10, I suspect we would be falling all over ourselves to get out there and to respond. And so keep this in mind. Just one of the many issues that you have to consider. Now, in addition to that of selection of endpoints, there's some practical considerations for achieving cleanup that we want to make sure that you're aware of. Again, the type and the amount of oil spilled, gasoline on a water body. Is it practical to go out and place boom to try to corral gasoline on a hot summer day? would you come at this in a different perspective if it were diesel and you were concerned about it being blown back into a marina? What if it were a heavy oil? What are the environmental sensitivities? Are you at a location where you can allow natural attenuation to play itself out versus are you at a location where because of use of some type that it's extraordinarily important to get in there and do something because it might be during the time of the year when, for example, the kokanee are dying on Lake Coeur d'Alene and the migratory eagles are passing through from Canada heading to Mexico, and it just so happens that the spill happened while the eagles are feeding on the kokanee and the like. So you have to be concerned with all of these things. Consultation goes to the point that Greg just made. Talk with your other responders, talk with the locals, other agencies, get their input and the like. And there's widely varying cleanup standards that may put you in a difficult situation. For example, EPA or other federal agencies may have a standard that you want to use, but that's at odds with a state or it's at odds with some other standard that people have asked you to consider. Some of the other practical considerations are the long-term deployment of absorbent materials. We mentioned these remote sites that we have here. And, you know, that might be 3 hours out of Missoula to get to the site, or it might be 6 hours out of Coeur d'Alene. And you don't want to keep people there 24/7, rather you might have a large group of people there for the first 48 or 72 or 96 hours, and then you put materials out and you want to come back and periodically check them. Is that reasonable? There's also the seasonal influence on the long-term deployment of booms. Obviously, we have high waterway during high water events, and booms placed during high water events may be of no value during low water events and the like. The second item is very important and one that we all struggle with, and that is not all spilled oil will be recovered. In these fast water scenarios, we may be lucky to get 3% or 15% or maybe much less than that. And you have to be accommodating of that. And as was described the other day, I believe, by Greg, some of the material may actually go into the bank. You might have fractured basalt or granite or something such as that. And you're not going to be able to recover that. You've taken, you know, great efforts to prevent or mitigate, if you will, but you can't recover at all. Something to consider. The effects of weather, of course, and then also natural attenuation. Okay. Other considerations when you can't get it all. What is the technical and operational feasibility? Is there a balance between cost and relation? Very, very important. Is there someone who can step in? What is the rate of natural removal processes? This is attenuation. And the important thing to mention about this is as you're struggling with this, you're going to be asking people to deal with things that in all likelihood they're very unfamiliar with, which is to say that they're risk adverse. So are they familiar or are they unfamiliar? What is the visibility of the threat? Is it something that you can see miles and miles downstream, or is it something that you have to crawl 40 feet down the bank and poke in and amongst the riprap that's the size of a Volkswagen, if you will, to actually see a sheen? What is the character of the affected resource? Are there equal and unequal effects? In other words, are there disproportionate effects that are borne by one particular person or entity or portion of the river as opposed to other. All things that, you need to take into consideration, or should take into consideration. Other thing you'd want to think of is what are the institutional constraints and pressures. For example, if a discharge happens in, let's say, on a reservation or in usual and customary areas that are used by Native Americans, you will likely find yourself dealing with a unique set of pressures with respect to cleanup and so on that would be different than if a release or a discharge were to occur in a more built-up urban area such as Tacoma or Seattle or something like that. Is the remaining oil likely to damage? Does it interfere with the aesthetic appeal and amenity use of the shoreline? And is it detrimental to economic resources, or does it disrupt economic activities? These are all things that you would want to consider as you're standing there and you realize that you just can't get it all, and you now have to start to make the argument for why you can't. And I've had to do this in several instances, and believe me, it's not easy, and it takes quite a bit of time to do so. Okay, on that note, we've completed this module. We've gone over quite a bit, and we would like to welcome any and all questions that you might have.
Okay, you guys can continue to submit those questions and comments into the Q&A window. We do have a few that have kind of come in already, but we did have one comment that Jim Mullins actually made. And Jim, I don't know if you want to just voice that up right now about the reality of oil spills.
Yeah, and one of the oil spill realities is when you spill oil into the water and then you clean it up, there's almost certainly going to be some measure of bathtub ring left. Now, exactly how bad the residual ring is varies with the endpoint that you've selected for this spill, but it's an unrealistic expectation to think you're going to get it all back.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, one of our first questions that came in, one of our participants wanted to know, when does the U.S. Coast Guard begin cost recovery? Do they communicate with the EPA OSC during the process? They're just wondering because they haven't heard about it from the U.S. Coast Guard regarding any of their own sites so far, and their sites have been completed as much as 6 months to a year ago.
Greg, I think you briefly touched on this yesterday. Would you like to add something to your conversation?
Yeah, whoever, you know, is the questioner, I'd give the Coast Guard a call and talk to the case officer. There's a number of factors that play into when they will initiate cost recovery. On a long-term response, they may initiate cost recovery, send a letter to the RP, reach out. They're pretty friendly guys. They'll reach out, they'll call the responsible party, and give them advice and notice that they can expect a demand letter for cost recovery. And they typically, I thought they initiate that fairly quickly after you end the response, and you do that by sending a final poll rep, and you include the case officer on that distribution so he knows that the response has ended. That begins the clock for statute of limitations, and they'll initiate cost recovery. Now, sometimes you want to specifically work on the timing of cost recovery with the Coast Guard. For a long-term response, you may not want them to send a demand letter or send a bill to the RP in the middle of the response and make the RP decide whether they're going to pay the bill or continue the response if they have limited funding. You may need to reach out to the case officer and explain that circumstance and ask them to hold off on submitting any sort of cost recovery demand until after the response is over. But if you conducted a response, it could be that the Coast Guard is doing the cost recovery and you don't know about it. But communication with the case officer is always a good thing. I'd give them a call and say, hey, what's going on with cost recovery in this case and that case? And that should solve it.
Okay. We did have one participant who actually shared a URL with us. They were referring individuals to a guide on using volunteers at oil spill sites. And I just was going to share that URL with everyone, that it was a great reference. It looked like it came from the NRT, I believe, with information about using your volunteers at oil spill sites. I don't know if any of the presenters have ever seen this document or wanted to comment on it.
Yes, I've actually used it and was somewhat involved early on, and I would strongly support getting this document, becoming familiar with it. And again, volunteerism isn't necessarily people coming down and asking to help pick things up. It might be people offering to bring you coffee and cookies or who knows what it might be. So it would be useful to have some familiarity with this whole notion of volunteers.
Okay. One of our participants would like to know if the role of an OSC in a spill is assumed at another level. Does the responsibility or liability of health and safety documentation go along with the assumption of delegated authorities?
All right. Well, I would take a crack at that, and I would say no. From my perspective, the OSC will continue to have overall responsibility for the site, even in those instances when there has been sort of a sharing of responsibility or an a passing of responsibility, if you will, to the state. I've never let go. Now, that whatever arrangement we might have with other parties does not negate their responsibilities to different statutes that, recall I mentioned yesterday with respect to the Clean Water Act. If we're dealing with CERCLA, we have the ability to waive compliance with what's referred to as ARARs, or applicable and relevant, applicable, relevant, and appropriate requirements with respect to environmental and siting issues. We have no ability whatsoever to waive the requirements that are imposed upon us or other persons by OSHA or other statutes that are not related to environmental or siting requirements. And so my answer to that is that we're always responsible. Other entities are always responsible for complying with all other rules and regulations. Greg or Jim, would you like to add something to that, perhaps?
Yeah, I'd like to add one point. This is Jim. In general, the authorities that the on-scene coordinator has been delegated are not redelegable. That is to say, they really can't pass those authorities that they have on because there is a prohibition against doing so. So the OSC becomes the person who has that responsibility, and whether they're actually physically present or not, it doesn't mean that they can leave their delegated authority in somebody else's hands. It is certainly possible to use others as eyes and ears, or to conclude that the response effort is appropriate without federal intervention or further federal intervention.
Yeah, Jim, thank you. It just goes to show how important certain words are, and so thank you for emphasizing that.
Okay, along that lines, we do have another participant that wanted to know if an OSC cannot redelegate authority, but the NCP says the OSC must direct response efforts. How exactly do you balance that imperative with allowing state agencies to manage?
Well, interesting question.
And a good.
Go ahead, Jim.
I'll get started, Earl, and then you pick up on this.
All right.
Essentially, there are not a large number of spills where the OSC is required to respond. Rather, most of them are discretionary on the part of the on-scene coordinator. They make an evaluation of the setting and of the response efforts that are being taken and whether they're being done in a timely and technically appropriate fashion, and they decide if they need to go. There are certainly some spills. Earl can talk to you about the one specifically that you don't have an option on that. You shall respond. But it's with the idea of discretionary response, it's perfectly all right. In fact, I would submit to you that most of the spill responses, whether it's hazardous materials or oil, occur under state or local oversight, and they do very well with it. There is no need for federal intervention on a lot of these. There certainly is for some, and this is a discretionary function. Okay, Earl, I'm sorry for taking up so much time.
Well, no, thank you, Jim. And the only thing that I would add to that is the NCP is clear that the OSC can either direct or monitor all federal, state, and private actions. And that's found in 300 Part 305. And so first and foremost, it's discretionary. There's nothing that says EPA has to respond. But were EPA to respond, we can deal with it. We can provide the needed oversight either directly or indirectly. And then I'd also like to emphasize Jim's point that EPA does not come in on each and every incident. The vast majority, we don't. We do so only in those instances when the state may be taxed during a particular period of time and they have other priorities and they would ask us to come in and lend a hand, or as Jim noted, as otherwise required by the NCP because of the character of the spill. So I hope that answers your question.
Okay. We have one participant who would like to know what types of actions are taken by OSCs to prevent spills from occurring in the first place.
Very good question. One of the responsibilities that OSCs has falls within the realm of preparedness. So response is just one half of the equation, so to speak. The other is to work in pre-planning activities. And so, for example, perhaps some of you are familiar with what's referred to as the SPCC rule, the Spill Prevention, Containment, and Countermeasure rule. You know, that rule is designed around prevention. And then there's other activities that we have to get involved with at area planning committees, regional response teams, and the like. And then within Region 10, and I suspect this may be the case with other regions, we have geographic areas for which we're responsible. So, for example, Greg is in downstate Idaho, and we pretty much just cut the state in half, and he gets stuff to the south, and I get stuff to the north. And within those broad geographic areas, we'll work with LEPCs, our local emergency planning committees, to help in whatever way we can to assist them with preparing for response to an incident, be it exercises or training or something of that nature. Greg or Jim, would you like to add something to that?
Well, we also, as you mentioned earlier, we work with regional response teams, area committees to develop geographic response plans, which are sub-plans under the area response plan. And we develop those for rivers and river segments and identify sensitive areas, and that's not prevention, but that facilitates the response.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and end the question break now and carry on. It's just after 2:30 p.m. Eastern, and we can move on to slide number 54. Participants can continue to submit those questions and comments at any time, though. We do have additional breaks scheduled throughout the remainder of our training time today.
Okay, so this is Greg, and I'm the presenter for this next section, Section 8, Oil Spill Response Techniques. So we have decided that we're going to respond. We've been notified. We have done the initial assessment, whether that's just gathering information via phone. We've understand our authority. We have accessed funding. We've opened up the fund. We know our NCP responsibilities. So what do we do? What do we do now other than knowing that we're going to respond? Well, whether it is direct response, EPA activating its contractors or activating resources via the other mechanisms we talked about, such as a PRFA, or whether it's EPA directing the response of a responsible party, as we talked about, or overseeing the response, we have to be involved in selecting from the smorgasbord of response alternatives and response technologies and options that are available to us, and determine which is most appropriate and which is going to get the job done and which will get it done in the most cost-effective manner. And there are a number of considerations that play into that. At the macro level, of course, those considerations include what media is it that we're going to be addressing. Is it a spill directly into water? Is that moving water? Is that marine or inland environment? Is that spill a one-time discharge or an ongoing discharge, say from the banks of a river? If that spill is not directly into water, then it is into soil, then we need to be considering, well, why? What are we responding to here? As Earl mentioned before, our response authority is not the Clean Dirt Act or the Clean Soil Act; it's the Clean Water Act. So if we're responding to a spill to soil, if it's on the banks of the river, of course we know what we're responding to. It's discharging to the river. We are likely going to need to excavate soils. If it's an upland response, well, it makes it a lot more difficult. Do we need to determine whether we're going to need to clean up soil to mitigate migration of that oil to navigable waters of the U.S. or a substantial threat of migration to navigable waters of the U.S., and whether that's just migration through vadal zone soils unsaturated, or whether that's migration to groundwater and then groundwater movement to and discharge to water of the U.S. So those are some of the macro considerations. At a more micro level, we're looking always at safety. I have never seen an oil spill that is worth risking getting somebody hurt over. Oil just isn't that important. Safety is the most important consideration. And if you have got a spill over a steep bank, you need to consider whether it's going to be safe to send somebody down there. If you've got icy conditions, if you are considering night operations, everything you do has to be thought of primarily through your lens and your responsibility as an OSC to ensure safety at the scene, and that you're not doing things that are unsafe, or that what you're doing, if they would otherwise be unsafe, you're taking the adequate precautions, such as going over a steep bank, that you have adequate rope and harness and essentially climbing gear. And we've seen that several times when we're cleaning riprap on a steepened riverbank. You need to consider access. As Earl indicated earlier, once oil is in the water and away from the source, you're not going to get very much of it. Once it's gotten away from the source and gone downstream or moved around with the tides or whatever, you're going to be lucky to get 10% of it. So when you're looking at places where you are going to establish your recovery setup or your containment, you need to consider safety and access, because if one place, although it might otherwise look good, but access is poor or unsafe, it's not worth it, because you know, in the end, it might make the difference between recovering 12% or 10% of the oil spilled. Cleanup alternatives for soil. And as I said, we must always be looking at soil through the lens of whether it is mobile in soil and mobile enough to discharge or present a substantial threat of discharge to navigable waters of the U.S. Now, if we have a spill, tank truck spill on the bank of the river, you've got oil in the water, you are trying to contain that source, and you're going to have to be digging up soil and riprap, you know, as an example of what we just discussed earlier. That's pretty clear. Cleanup alternatives with respect to soil vary depending on whether we're talking ex situ, whether that means excavated soils, and the cleanup alternatives we're considering there probably have to do with cleaning up soils as an alternative to disposal, and probably a cost-effective alternative. So we might be thinking of land farming, which is identifying an appropriate piece of land. It usually, at least here in Idaho, must be approved by the state DEQ, where the property owner is willing to accept that contaminated soil, spread it at a certain depth, and cultivate it until through the natural processes, microbial activity, evaporation, and whatever, that the hydrocarbons are reduced to a level that is acceptable for placement elsewhere or to remain permanently at the site. Land spreading is similar, but just does not involve the tilling or cultivation. It's spread thinly over the land and monitored and determined that at some point it no longer presents a hazard, and that you're usually coordinating with the state environmental authority on identifying appropriate places for doing that. Those are ex situ examples of soil cleanup, and as I said, that's usually excavated soils where you're looking at an alternative to disposal. In situ, we have other options, and again here, we are looking at mitigating concentrations of hydrocarbons in soils that might be mobile and present a threat of discharge to waters of the U.S., whether that's in the vadose zone soils or in the saturated. What do we got? Bioventing, I guess. Bioremediation, natural attenuation and monitoring. An appropriate response and what might be appropriate under your funding authority is attenuation monitoring, particularly if we're talking about soils and groundwater. And we might not know whether or not it presents a threat of discharge to waters of the U.S. if it's in an upland area. We might not know the groundwater gradient and flow direction, whether it's to the river or away from the river. And it may take monitoring over time, even monitoring over a full year, quarterly monitoring to gather data over the four seasons of the year to understand that. And that's an appropriate response. That's part of either the response or site investigation that might be funded under the federal project number. Of course, when we're talking about soils and we're talking about excavation, of soils along the bank, we're also engaging the Clean Water Act, Clean Water Act 404 permit requirements. And as you know, though it's typically a site-specific permit for doing any of that type of work, whether it's placing fill materials or excavating materials at the waterline or on the bank. Fortunately for us in this work, we have a nationwide permit, and there are certain permit requirements that we should understand before undertaking or allowing or authorizing the work that would be required, that would engage the Clean Water Act 404 requirements. I'll talk more about that later. Cleanup alternatives for groundwater. Like soils, we're talking about contaminated groundwater and selecting a cleanup alternative only to the extent that contaminated groundwater represents a threat of discharge to navigable waters of the U.S. And when we're talking about contaminated groundwater, we're usually considering a couple things, whether we have LNAPL on groundwater, light non-aqueous phase liquid, basically free-floating product on groundwater. If we have a, and that's what we're most typically concerned with, if we've had a spill in an upland area, 50 feet, you know, it's above the bank, but in a flat area 50 feet from, 500 feet from the Clearwater River. We've had a pipeline break at a gasoline facility. They've installed some monitoring wells. They've determined that they have free phase floating product. Well, that's likely to present a threat of discharge. We might not know that directly. We might not know that there is a seep from that groundwater to the river, but we suspect that there very well might be at some point of the year, and that free phase floating product, that LNAPL, presents a threat of discharge and needs to be removed. We would likely do that by installing some monitoring wells. That's how we found the LNAPL in the first place, and putting floating skimmers in those monitoring wells, or adjustable skimmers or self-adjustable skimmers to pump off that product. And as you do so, you'd draw additional product into that well. Another alternative that would be more aggressive if you're trying to keep that product from migrating towards the river would be pumping down groundwater as well and creating a cone of depression to draw more product into that well and draw it away from migrating towards the river. That way you would recover more product, but you've got a lot more water to deal with as well, contaminated water that you'd have to determine what to do with. These other cleanup alternatives for groundwater are applicable once you have removed the LNAPL. If you've got LNAPL on groundwater, you're not so concerned about remediation of dissolved phase contaminants in the groundwater itself, because those contaminants are going to continue to dissolve into the groundwater until you've got that free phase layer removed. So your first priority is to remove that product off of the groundwater. And once you've done that, you might determine, even though you have significant concentrations of BTEX, you know, typically the constituents that you measure for associated with gasoline, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, you might have significant concentrations in groundwater and determine that, well, that doesn't present, in my mind, a threat of discharge or meet those discharge requirements with respect to a sheen or potential sheen on navigable waters of the U.S., a sludge, or water contamination above applicable water quality standards. And that's the trick, and that's the key for contaminated groundwater. Do you have a discharge of those dissolved contaminants above applicable water quality standards? And if you do, you would likely have the authority to continue that response action to address that groundwater, and you have a number of options for being able to do that. Monitored natural attenuation, of course, is one. You'd likely need to monitor groundwater in those wells for a number of seasons. If you've got a various conditions with respect to how that groundwater might flow towards or away from the river. If you've got a seep and you've got discharge and migration of that groundwater to the river and into the river, one way to deal with that might be a permeable reactive barrier, digging a trench near the riverbank, installing some reactive compound, whether it's activated carbon or even peat moss, to absorb the contaminants and polish the water before it, treat the water before it moves through and to the river, so that hopefully when it gets to the river it does not exceed applicable water quality standards. Chemical oxidation, injecting strong oxidizers in, such as Fenton's reagent or potassium permanganate are quite effective in breaking down those contaminants. Bioremediation, stimulating native microbial activity in the groundwater. Air sparging is essentially in situ air stripping, or pumping out that water and treating it. Those are some of the alternatives you have. Like I say, though, they should always be looked at with respect to what extent they're going to mitigate that discharge, threat of discharge to navigable water of the U.S., and once you've met that criteria, then you're done. It may not satisfy your state partner, who has perhaps greater responsibility for contaminated soils and groundwater, but we have very strict limits in, with respect to our authority in this area. Anything to add on that, Earl or Jim?
Well, I your last comment, I think, is one worth emphasizing, Greg. It's our authority is very well laid out in 311C, and that includes mitigation or prevention of a substantial threat. And mitigation or prevention, if you will, could be a highly elastic term, which results in residual amounts of product that might be in the soil that would have maybe one opportunity a year to cause a sheen. But in the big scheme of things, it's time to walk away from our perspective when you start to balance that impact with respect to cost and any added degree of protection or reduction or risk afforded by additional cleanup. And needless to say, not everyone agrees with that. In some instances, the state may agree with us, or it may not. Tribal entities may agree with us, or they may not. And so, you know, these are all tough issues that we struggle with, and oftentimes they play out over the course of many years. But it's an important distinction worth knowing, is that mitigation and prevention, particularly with respect to groundwater and soil, is very challenging, to say the least. Jim, would you like to add to it?
No, I think that's fine. I think we need to go back, of course, to the fundamentals, and that is if we're using the Clean Water Act Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund to address groundwater, it's because it's discharging oil to a surface water. That's a fundamental reason for response. You may be using other authorities, but if it's not, if the contaminated groundwater is not discharging oil to the surface water, we don't have authority to use the statute.
Right.
So it's much easier than, and I think the rest of this module will deal with oil on water, oil in surface water, and that is clear. When we have oil and water that is causing a sheen of any kind, we have the discretionary authority to respond. There are a few, I guess, limitations that Earl went over, but if you've got a any sort of spill that causes a sheen on surface water, we have the authority to respond. Areas and berms. Natural attenuation and monitoring. Is basically a no-action alternative, and that can be considered a viable response alternative for oil that, particularly if it's in marshes or wetlands. One of the key decisions we have to make is if our response actions might cause more harm than good. And oil in marshes and wetlands sometimes is not that horrible a thing. There's great, you know, microbial activity and nutrients, and if we don't have immediate direct wildlife impacts, it might not take long for that that oil to attenuate naturally. The cleanup alternatives, whether it's going in there with equipment or by hand and cutting vegetation and trying to remove that oil, might cause more harm than good. Natural attenuation monitoring is more typical of wetlands, marsh areas where we think that any active cleanup measure might cause more harm than good. And we'd be looking to monitoring that. It's as an active feature, as an active part of the response under the work that's funded by the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, monitoring that to ensure that over time over hopefully a short amount of time, that that oil in that environment is degraded by natural means so that it no longer continues to pose a threat.
Comment on that, if I may, Greg. Natural attenuation and monitoring is very typically selected as the completion point for oil spill responses when there's been a very vigorous mechanical recovery and there's been a lot of hard work done. You don't quite get it all. This is what happens to the last of it, and it's you need to have that firmly ingrained as the likely outcome of the best cleanup.
Yeah, okay. Excellent. Thanks, Jim. And that's part of what we talked about earlier in Earl's segment. And just coming to that endpoint requires a lot of upfront work with the other trustees and your state partners so that they understand that we may not be able to get it all, and there may be a point where continued response actions cause more harm than good, and we'll just have to watch it and monitor and let it attenuate.
Well, and the other point is cost, frankly. You know, we don't like to say that cost is what's driving a cleanup, but cost is always a part of the decision-making process, and the cost may be so disproportionate to any benefit gained that natural attenuation becomes the preferred alternative.
Yeah. Good. Preventive alternative, if we know we've got a spill that is moving downstream, is likely to hit the shore, would be barriers and berms. It's a easy. Preventing oil from entering an estuary or entering a wetland or an inlet or preventing it from going over the beach is far easier than trying to clean it up once it's gotten there. And it might be as simple a matter as getting a piece of equipment there to create a berm. And if you can do that and do it before the oil gets there, you are so far ahead of the game. The thing that I mentioned previously and that you need to consider is the Clean Water Act 404 permit requirement. And for oil spill response, we have a permit, a nationwide permit that we access. We don't have to get a site-specific permit. It's nationwide permit number 20. But we need to know that that's how we're doing this work whenever we're applying material, whether it's in the water channel on the beach to create a berm. We are doing it under a Clean Water Act permit, and there are certain permits requirements. They're very broad, but we should be aware of that.
Yeah, but just cutting one other comment. The permit requirements are typically BMPs, or best management practices. In other words, things that would have to be done to prevent or otherwise mitigate the impact of surface waters.
But creating a berm or barrier, such as in this photo, to an inlet is so much easier than trying to clean it up once it's in there, or even trying to boom it and keep it from getting in there via booming, particularly if it's in a tidally influenced waters where you have water moving in and out or up and down. It's very hard to maintain boom in that environment. And if you can put enough material in there to cut it off, you've saved a lot of effort. And that material then is not that hard to remove afterwards. Debris removal in, I think we're talking here about proactive debris removal. One of the biggest problems once with cleanup is managing all the contaminated debris, particularly if you've got a strong, you know, rack line on the beach, if you've got a lot of flooding debris. You know, if you've got overbank flooding and deposit of the spilled oil, if you can get out there ahead of time proactively and remove debris, you can get it out of the way. You don't have to deal with it as waste. In fact, you can put it back afterwards and try to rehabilitate that area afterwards. A consideration. The more resources you can get out there quickly to do this kind of work ahead of the spill, if it's coming downstream or going to hit the shore, you save so much work after the fact that it makes a whole lot of sense. Once you have contaminated beach, contaminated bank, contaminated riprap, there are a number of things you can do to try to clean that up. One of those alternatives is flooding with low pressure water, deluge. It takes a lot of ability to pump water, but you can deluge, flood the beach, flood the riprap bank, and push that oil into the water. You're going to have containment around that area to contain that oil, and then a way to recover that oil. Whenever we're talking about containment, we need to first have thought about the recovery and how we're going to recover oil from that containment area. I'll get into more details on that later. But this is a photo of workers in a small ship that pumping the water to be able to spray multiple streams of water and deluge and flood that oil back into the water where it can be recovered. High pressure flushing, not as preferred. It gets into some of the techniques that need to be used very carefully. High pressure flushing or high pressure and hot water flushing can cause more harm in some cases than good. It can force oil further down into the sediments, can wash away all the fine-grained material in between rocks and riprap, and make it much more difficult for that environment to rehabilitate. Might be appropriately used when you've got hard riprap that needs to be cleaned rather than removing the riprap. And you can do it in a way where you're not washing out all the material in between the riprap that's holding it together and that's providing a habitat. Flushing with high pressure and hot water, again, something that you're adding the additional benefit of not only forcing the oil down further into the sediments and washing away the fines, but of sterilizing those sediments too with hot water, so making it even more difficult for that beach to recover. So again, it has to be used. Not all of these techniques are advisable. They have to be used under certain specific situations. High pressure hot water flooding was used extensively, the Exxon Valdez, and we've learned a whole lot since then. The study of the beaches and the various techniques that were used there have shown that where we use high pressure hot water washing and our application on some of the cobbly beaches, The oil that was pushed down into the sediments still remains, and by using the hot water, sort of sterilized those beaches and eliminated or reduced the ability for microbial bioremediation of that soil. So some of these techniques you just have to be careful. On hard surfaces, they might be appropriate. If you're decontaminating a boat, hot water, high pressure might be appropriate. Typically not on cobbly or sandy beaches. Low pressure, deluge flooding, as we saw before, is more appropriate and more what you would see anymore. It requires the ability to pump a lot of water and just flood and mobilize that oil from the surfaces, usually hard surfaces, cobble, rocky beaches or shorelines, or riverbanks, riprap riverbanks, and mobilizing that into the water where you can contain it and recover it. Manual removal, typically appropriate for tar balls, tar mats, where the stuff has weathered to the point that it has some cohesion to it, and you can pick it up with buckets, shovels, rakes. Usually on beaches, manual removal and cleaning was an important part of the cleanup for the Gulf
Deepwater
Horizon spill. Mechanical removal, again, was used on beaches for the Deepwater Horizon. It's essentially sifting the top layer of sand and recovering those tar balls, even the small tar balls. It's not so effective for oil that's below those first top 6 inches or foot or so. Do you have anything to add on that, Jim? Or
no, the mechanical oil removal can be, the material removed may be put to good use for highway construction, for example, but that's just a possibility, not always a reality.
Yeah, good, thanks.
And I also just wanted to pop on and do a quick time check. It's about 3:04, and you're on slide number 70.
So I should hurry up?
That would be the subtle message, yes. Thank you.
Well, a lot of these we can buzz through.
Thank you, Greg.
What's that?
Gene,
a lot of these we can buzz through.
Are amazing.
Physical herding is concentrating oil. Just by water, it's amazing how effective you can do that with a hose. It wants to stay together, and you can force it up into an area where you can recover it. You can concentrate it, force it up to a thickness where you can recover it easily with a skimmer. Vacuuming, using a vac truck might work best here. That guy, where's my arrow? This guy here, that might get a little old after a while, and he's probably not very effective just with that vacuum end hose and having to bend over. This guy here is probably a lot more effective, probably getting a lot less water, particularly if he has maybe a duckbill on the end of that hose, where he can put it right above the oil level and just pull off that sheen or that oil. What you want to be careful of when you're vacuuming is that you're not pulling in a lot of water, whether you're vacuuming or skimming. You're usually going to get some amount of water. You'll have to put that through a separator and deal separately with the water and oil fractions, but you want to minimize the water, minimize the volume that you're picking up that is not oil. Vegetation cutting. Here you see, and it looks at this picture like you might have thought about whether you're causing more harm than good by vegetation cutting. Vegetation cutting is certainly a viable response option. Again, we want to look at what our authority is, and it's to mitigate a discharge or threat of discharge to navigable waters of the U.S. If you've got stained vegetation, you don't, maybe after a over-the-bank flood or in a marsh environment, you've got some stained vegetation. You need to determine at what point, one, are you causing more harm than good by cutting that vegetation going in there and trying to remove it, and two, what amount of staining or oil on that vegetation consists of a threat of discharge to waters of the U.S. So it looks like here they pretty well trampled this area, and they might have thought about whether they're doing more harm than good. And also you have all of the cut vegetation then that you have to dispose of. Not that vegetation isn't sometimes, cutting vegetation isn't sometimes viable response option, but you need to consider those things. Okay, so containment is the key. Well, containment is one of your goals when you're putting out boom, and I'd submit that it's probably your lowest priority. Your first priority is going to be protection, and that's the easiest to do, and that is has the most bang for the buck in terms of utilizing a limited amount of boom. When you're talking containment, you're usually talking about getting, as Earl said, 10% of the spilled oil, maybe at best. But we're expected to try to contain and recover oil, and we do to get that 8, 10, 15%. When you're thinking about containment, the first thing you should also be thinking about is recovery, how you're going to get the oil out of your containment area. Do you have adequate access? Do you have the appropriate means to get it out? Do you have skimmers, or are you just using absorbents? If you're using absorbents, what are you going to do with all the spent absorbents? Do you have access? So those are the things you need to think about before you decide to set out your containment boom. It's no good to contain oil in a place where you don't have access, and if you don't have storage capacity for that recovered oil. Containment is difficult. It usually requires you getting out into the river with boats and having anchor hardware and recovery hardware, and those are some of the things we're going to talk about.
Hey, Greg, if I could add, this is an excellent example to provide some additional insight into the person who asked about preparedness. At one point, you mentioned GRPs, or geographic response plans, that might be out there for a particular water body. Were you to have one, the GRP would address all of the issues that Greg just mentioned with respect to tactics, how to get in, what to place, so on and so forth. So that's another example of, from a preparedness perspective, were you to have a GRP, would do away with a lot of the second guessing and otherwise initial work that would otherwise be the case were you not to have a GRP.
Thanks, Earl. And I'm just going to critique their containment here in this picture a little bit. Typically, what we do when we develop a containment system with boom is that we create a J hook on the end, to keep it off the shore and to be able to recover the oil out in the water and not up against the shore. So what we would do when we teach the oil spill response course, and we've taught the fast water oil spill response training here just outside of Boise for over 20 years here. It's ERT training, but we've hosted it here at the Black Canyon Dam. It wasn't done this last year because of funding, and I'm not sure when it'll be done again, but we've done this course for about 20 years here. But what we teach is that you create a J, you bring the end of your boom up and have the hook in your J out in the water, and that's where you collect the oil, that's where you put your skimmer. This is a drum skimmer, a floating drum skimmer, which I really like a lot. You're seeing more and more of those. We'll talk about those later. But it just rotates, and it has an oleophilic surface on that drum. It picks up the oil and deposits it in a sump where it's pumped off into your drum or whatever. Doesn't pick up a lot of water. It can be used where there's some chop on the water, and it's not susceptible to getting fouled by debris. It's really a neat little skimmer as opposed to, say, a Weir skimmer that you just see a lot more of. I need to move through these slides quickly, I guess. Okay, containment. Yippee, let's move on. Commercial booms. The various kinds of booms. What we're usually talking about, though, is internal flotation. And these other types of boom I'm going to zip through because you usually don't see them very much. Internal flotation boom. It's three-part. Usually it has freeboard where the float is and where a cable runs through for strength, for tensile strength. It has a skirt, and that's the part that hangs below the water. Can be 6 inches, 8 inches, 1 foot, even fast water boom might be a 4 foot skirt. The more skirt you have, the more drag you're going to have, the less ability you will have to be able to put it across the current in a river or fast flowing water. They usually come in 50 to 100 foot sections. It's what you will see most everywhere, at least here in Region 10. We have working with our state partners throughout most of Region 10. We have small trailers, boom trailers, where 1,000 feet of this internal flotation boom can fit into a trailer about the size of a horse trailer with hardware and anchors that you need. And we've located these trailers throughout most of the region where we don't have other access via the OSROs, spill response organizations, where we don't have other easy access. So Washington Ecology and the Idaho Hazmat teams, they have boom trailers where they just have 1,000 feet of boom. They can deploy that. And when you've only got a limited amount of boom, of course, your first priority is protection. And it's this internal float boom, much like you see there. They have standard connectors, and you need to think about what sort of hardware you need with it, bridle, line, anchors, and stakes to be able to anchor that. The other kind of boom, I've never seen spring-loaded boom. You probably won't either. Self-inflatable, I've seen that. That's usually at a fixed facility. It requires maybe a third of the storage space of the regular internal flotation boom. You usually see it on a fixed reel, and I've seen it at FRP facilities where they required under their facility response plan to have a certain amount of boom and be able to deploy it within a certain amount of time, and they might have these off of the dock or in an area where they know they can deploy it quickly and deploy it right off the reel. You really don't see it much, or I haven't, in mobile spill response application. Fire boom, well, I've never seen that used, but I guess when you need to contain oil in open water to be able to initiate in situ burn, this boom somehow doesn't burn up in the fire. And shoreline boom, I've never seen that either. It looks like it's just very easily conforms to the substrate there to keep oil from leaking out along the shoreline. And really, it seems like a solution to a problem that you really shouldn't have. If you're designing your containment correctly, creating that J, you might have to key the skirt in a little bit there at the shoreline. You shouldn't have a whole lot of leakage of sheen, along the shoreline. Or if you do, it's really not that big a deal. Like I said before, by the time you're trying to capture oil downstream, you're only getting a small fraction of it anyway. I've seen where a lot of times we spend so much time worrying about our containment and losing maybe a little bit from our containment, whether it's entrainment or at the shore, and not worrying enough about, well, how are we going to recover it from our containment area, and are we protecting the highest priority resources at risk? So, if you're so concerned about losing a little bit along where the water meets the shore, it's a good place to be using some absorbent boom. Oh, absorbent boom. Well, we've got absorbent boom in here. Really, there is no such thing. Absorbent is absorbent, and boom is boom. And absorbent boom is not really boom. It has no skirt. It floats on top. And I like to highlight that problem because language is sometimes important. And when we're talking to our local response contractor, we're talking to a local hazmat team, they'll say they have boom. They'll say they have 1,000 feet of boom. That's great. Well, sometimes it turns out to be just this sorbent boom, which doesn't really contain anything. It's sorbent. It's not containment boom.
And good point, Greg. And it's best used in tandem with boom, for example. That's where you oftentimes see it deployed.
Yeah, exactly, on the inside of boom. And it's not even, the best absorbent, because it has a very small surface area. It'll soak up the oil, but if we're trying to capture sheen, I've seen best, you don't see so much as the absorbent boom out there is the sweep. It's essentially the sorbent pads on a line, and you got much more surface area, and it's much better at recovering sheen. Commercial boom versus the advantages, quick to deploy, reusable, needs to be decontaminated after use, and you need to store it properly and store it out of the sunlight. It'll degrade in the sunlight, and then when you try to pull it out there, it'll just fall apart. So we use trailers, those, I forget, I don't know exactly what size their trailers but around here is like a double horse trailer size trailer, and you can put 1,000 feet of boom in there. Improvised boom, that seems kind of ridiculous to me. I've never seen it done. I've seen it taught, but putting plastic around a hose line, well, I don't know how you'd even hold the plastic down, why it wouldn't just float up. Telephone poles, what are you going to do? Drop a telephone pole into the water. I don't know. Functions of boom, protection, deflection, containment, those I think are listed pretty much in order of importance. First thing you should be thinking about is protection. Do you have downstream drinking water intakes, especially? Do you have industrial water intakes or irrigation water diversions? Or around here, we've got fish hatcheries, very sensitive to water quality. Sensitive shorelines, marinas, inlets. Those are the things that can be easily protected. And if you've got a limited amount of boom, you can deploy that boom without having to get out in the middle of the current and without having to develop complex anchor systems or Tyrolean rigging or whatever. That's the best use of a limited amount of boom. Deflection. To the extent possible, you want to be working with the current, not against the current. And what you'll see for collection is that the oil wants to collect on its own, and it'll collect in back eddies. And if those are places where you have access, that's where you want to set up your collection. You don't want to try to set up a collection out in the current unless you absolutely have to. And maybe the second most important use of your boom is to deflect oil to one of those natural collection areas. Move it from the outside of the curve to the inside of the curve where it's going to deflect on the back end of that, or where it's going to collect on the back end of that curve. And you might set your containment there to just ensure that it's not getting away from you, and deflect oil into that collection point. But the idea is to be working with the river, not against it, to the extent possible. One, you know, as I said, we do the fast water booming class out here, outside of Boise, and I think the most important thing you learn is what you can't do and how strong that water is and how difficult it is to try to set boom across that water. You learn what you can't do is more importantly than what you can do. Okay, containment, we've talked about that. Containing oil, and the thing you need to think about when you're setting up containment, of course, is recovery. Do you have the access to be able to recover it, whether it's to get down there with a vacuum truck or be able to set up fast tanks? Do you have the area to put oil in that you're recovering and get it out of there? Okay, dams and weirs. Very good, particularly, you know, if you've got a culvert. One of the examples we used yesterday was that we had a tank truck go in on the cut bank side of a road, and on the other side was a river, and we had water coming. Maybe we had a storm coming, and it's going to want to push that oil through the culvert under the road into the river. Well, we're going to have to allow that water to go, otherwise we're going to flood the road. What might we do? A simple piece of plywood partway over that culvert can help hold back the oil while letting the water go through, and you may need to adjust that as the water picks up, if indeed you have a storm coming through, to allow more water to go through without allowing the oil to go through. But it's a good, easy way to recover oil, particularly when you've got a culvert or a ditch. Quickcrete dam, well, that's that looks to me like a real mess for when you're going to have to haul that all that straw out of there. All of that will have to be disposed of. And once the straw gets, maybe that's why you're putting quickcrete on it, but once that straw gets saturated, it is so heavy and difficult to get out of there. It doesn't want to come out in bales. It's going to fall apart, and it's going to be a big mess. Underflow dams. There's a number of examples. The things to, and here's a schematic up above. And the things to understand about an underflow dam are that you can control the elevation and the buildup of water behind the dam with the elevation of the outlet. You know, the inlet is low to allow water to go through the outlet. On the back side of the dam, you set at the elevation that you want to back up water to. In these examples, some of the things you'll observe here are that maybe down here, you'll get significant erosion on the back side of that dam if you don't armor that. So I usually suggest having some gravel. If you're using dirt, all you need is an excavator and some PVC pipe to set up an underflow dam. It's very effective, particularly in ditches or small well-defined channels. But you'll want to ensure that you're armoring the discharge so that it doesn't erode your dam and destroy your dam. You might want to put plastic on the upgrading side here so that you're not contaminating this soil and saturating that soil with oil. Here's an underflow dam that, this looks like a disaster to me. This looks like a mess. They have one discharge pipe there that looks like it probably wasn't sufficient, and I see a lot of, looks to me like oil staining on the dam and downstream. So that looks like what likely happened was that they weren't passing enough water, and the oil that was on top was pushed over the dam, contaminated that dam, and went over the other side. When you're doing something like this, it's important that you don't make things worse than they are, and that when building an underflow dam that you provide enough passage of water so that you don't overtop the dam, because then you're just pushing oil over and you're creating more of a mess. But it's pretty easy with a dozer or a hoe and some PVC pipe to build these things. That's a fixed underflow dam. Weirs we talked about. It can essentially be as easy as having a piece of plywood over a culvert and being able to move that up and down with the water flow. Gate valves can be used in the same way. And there's a fixed weir. Straw locks. Again, this looks like a huge mess to me. This is a negative example. You've got a bunch of loose straw in there. And the straw bales, you can usually set them in there by hand. You might put them in there with stakes. The thing you have to think about, though, is how the heck you're going to get them out of there. Because once they become saturated, they are unbelievably heavy. And you'll need a hoe to get them out of there. And do you have access to be able to do that? If they're all contaminated with oil, then they become a disposal problem. So straw log containment, it can be effective at containing, but you need to think about how you're going to get the straw out of there. If you have to leave it in there, then it'll continue to be a source for a long time. If it's contaminated, it'll continue to create sheen. So you don't want that. You'll have to get it out of there somehow. Same situation here. Straw looks good. It is effective, but the bales go in easy. They don't come out so easy. What might be more effective is putting some straw, loose straw, in a wire structure that is more easily removable. Fences, I think this is the same type of thing, fences with straw. Again, you need to think about how you're going to get it out of there and what you're going to do with it, because it'll contribute to your disposal issue once you've removed it.
Greg's absolutely right about the difficulty in getting the hay removed, and I think it's probably most frequently used when there's no other alternative booming that's available in the near term. So a lot of times, particularly in the oil-producing parts of the country where we have a lot of a pasture for cows, it's common to see hay everywhere, and so you have a lot of boom-type material that works absent any other alternatives.
All right, I got to buzz through these, I think, pretty quickly.
Yep.
These are just some pictures showing some alternatives. I won't talk a lot about them. Recovery is the thing you should be thinking about at the time you're wondering where you're going to put your containment in, because containing oil without the ability to recover it is not very good. We've got here some examples. I can't see all these, but the upper top left is a floating drum skimmer. I talked about that. You're seeing more and more of those. They have a lot of advantages. They just continue to chug along. You don't have to adjust them. That water just adheres to that drum, and it's scraped off by a squeegee or a wire, or a wiper, into the sump and pumped off. And they're not bothered by debris. They're not bothered by a little chop. They're very, very good. Down here on the lower right is a floating weir skimmer. You can see the three floats on the outside and then the weir in the middle. Those used to be what you'd get when you called up for a skimmer, and they're more difficult to maintain. You typically have to have a thicker layer of oil because you got to set that weir level at the oil level. You want to pull in oil and not water. It requires adjustment. If you got a little bit of chop, you know, you're going to get a lot of water, and they're easily fouled by debris. So you're seeing more and more of the floating drum skimmers, and they come in various sizes. Another, the most effective thing I've seen for recovering oil is mop rope setup, and I don't think we have a picture of that, but that is a rope, circular rope with a bunch of oleophilic, you know, like mop head stuff on it, and you anchor it out in your containment area, probably usually in two places, so you're creating a triangle with the one end of the triangle on the shore where that rope is powered by a motor, and then it goes through a squeegee, and that thing just running all the time through that, in a triangle through the containment area, it picks up a whole lot of oil, picks it up pretty quickly. It requires some maintenance because that rope kind of wants to twist and in the application. And then sorbents, of course, when you're using sorbents, you're creating disposal problems. Alternative countermeasures, I need to spend a little more time on these because there's a lot of important considerations. When we're talking about applying stuff to water, chemical dispersants, surface washing agents, surfactants, bioremediation agents. We're talking about substances that are approved. Well, they're not approved, I guess, isn't the right word, but they're listed on the NCP product schedule, subpart J, which means that they may be considered for use by the OSC. If it's not on on the product schedule, it means it should not be considered for use. Chemical dispersants are used to solubilize or emulsify oil on the water to put it into the water column and disperse it and keep it from washing it up on the shore, keep it from washing into a sensitive wetland. But it needs to be used with a lot of consideration, and typically you will have a scientific support staff or environmental unit that is determining whether chemical dispersants are the way to go or not. And you will have to rely on a whole lot of scientific input for that decision. Use of dispersants must be approved by the regional response team. In Region 10, at least in the lower three states or the coastal states, Washington and Oregon, we have pre-approval by the RRT for use of dispersants when it's 3 miles offshore, off the coastline or more. Any other use of dispersants closer than 3 miles or in the inland area require case-by-case approval by the RRT. Now, I mentioned yesterday an example, there is an exception to that RRT approval requirement where the OSC can approve the use of dispersants in a situation that presents an immediate life health risk factor, and the dispersant needs to be used to mitigate that. And it's usually in a limited or small application or circumstance. We did that. I approved the use of dispersant product on the NCP product schedule in a storm sewer system to knock down the LEL and the explosive atmosphere throughout that storm sewer system, put the product, there was water flowing in the storm sewer, put product into that water that subsequently discharged to the Payette River, but we had to do it, we felt, to keep an explosion hazard down throughout the town. Biological agents are microbes, cultures, enzymes, nutrient additives that assist in the biodegradation of fuel. Typically, you know, I think of biological agents used for groundwater or soil remediation rather than surface water, where you might, you know, particularly in a marsh or wetland environment, if you've got plenty of nutrients, plenty of microbial activity. In situ burning is the burning of oil, and that's often seen as a can be seen by some trustees as a positive environmental function. It perhaps is not used very often because of the need to ensure that that we can control the fire and that we can monitor the air, but it is a viable response alternative. The NCP recognizes the OSC's authority to use in situ burn. You need to go work closely with your state partners to ensure you'd have appropriate environment air monitoring protocols and ensure that you've got fire safety ability to control the fire up appropriately. Earl or Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think OSCs can approve in situ burns except or unless when you're using a burning agent. Anything that's applied probably needs to be approved by the RRT. In most cases, you'd need to use a burning agent. Do you happen to know more about that? I'm not quite certain on that.
You're on the right track. I think it varies some from regional office to regional office. The RRTs tend to strike agreements in Region 6 and Region 4 and Region 5 about what constitutes an appropriate set of conditions for in situ burning, and certainly the idea of using an accelerant is something that you need to run through the regional response team.
Yeah, exactly, and we've got a decision tree protocol here in Region 10 as well. But the NCP specifically recognizes this as a potential response action. Protecting wildlife means keeping the oil from getting into sensitive environmental areas, wetlands, sensitive shorelines. That's an important function. It can also mean keeping the wildlife away from the oil, which might involve hazing. I think you see a hazing gun there. Again, you're going to be relying on support from your environmental units, support from your scientific support coordinator, perhaps on or your wildlife specialist on identifying the appropriate actions here. But the most important key is the identification of those sensitive environments and protecting them from getting oiled in the first place.
Right, and then one other added dimension to this, Craig, is that this would likely trigger the emergency consultation provisions for the Endangered Species Act, because even such things as harassment, it I believe falls under the definition of a taking, and so you would have to work closely with National Marine Fisheries or Fish and Wildlife. And then with respect to the capture and treatment of oiled wildlife, that's an excellent opportunity to bring in volunteers. In fact, there's many organizations throughout the country who do that, as they're the ones who can assist with the recovery and the cleaning and then the reintroduction of oiled wildlife.
Yeah, but expanding upon that, you do need specialized contractors for doing capture and treating of oiled wildlife. They may then be able to use volunteers, but you do need specialized expertise for that. Okay, we'll go quickly through what we have, disposal, and then be able to have time to answer questions. Of course, disposal is part of your response action, a necessary part of your response action, something that you should have been planning from the very start when you were selecting your response options, and you need to be thinking about the waste that you're generating. It can be oil, recovered oil, it can be oily water, can be soil, excavated soil, oil debris, or even PPE. And here we've got got some of those things. Oil and oil, oily water. You want to, of course, try to utilize techniques that minimize the recovery of water when you're trying to recover oil. That means being careful and monitoring your skimmers, monitoring, you know, the how you're vacuuming oil to ensure that you're being careful and just pulling to the extent possible oil off the top and not water also. You are obviously going to get water, and you're going to want to separate water and oil to the extent possible. And that usually requires letting it sit, having some residence time, putting it in an oil-water separator, a tank that might have some baffles and facilitates the separation of oil and water and has the capability to draw water from or oil from various levels in the tank. So water separated from oil, you might use oil-water separator specific tanks. In some places where you have a limited capacity to store recovered oil, or you are trying to minimize the amount of oil that you have to send off for reuse or disposal or recovery, you might consider decanting water that is separated off from the oil and decanting that water fraction back into the containment area. I know here in Region 10 we have certain procedures. It usually requires approval by the State Department of Environmental Quality, and it requires that you decant that water, that it be inspected so that there isn't a sheen on the water, and be decanted back into the area where you're recovering from. But recovered oil may be sent for recycling or reprocessing. Might be used to recover the BTU value, you know, sent for fuel. They can accept, you know, oil, emulsified oil, oil water up to a certain amount, certain percent. Debris is a more difficult problem. Generally have to determine whether it can be disposed of as a non-hazardous waste, whether it can be burned or whether it needs to be disposed of as hazardous. You might develop some hazardous waste if you're using certain solvents. Also, any waste that you generate needs to be characterized, and it could be that it's characteristic hazardous and needs to be disposed of properly. You have anything to add to disposal, Earl?
Well, it can be more complicated than I guess your first thoughts. As you said, there's an array of waste that you have to deal with, from the product itself, the PPE, and imagine all of the discarded debris, organic or manufactured debris that you find along the streams. More often than not, you're recovering this. And depending upon the nature of the event, for example, if it's a discharge incidental to another event, such as a hurricane or something of just a massive flood, you're going to find any number of different materials then that you're going to have to be responsible for. And early on, we made the point of saying that there are provisions within CERCLA that exempt oil, but if that oil becomes contaminated, then you're going to have to go through the process of determining whether or not it's a hazardous waste. And if you do that, then you're bringing in all other types of regulatory frameworks. One that we mentioned earlier is RCRA, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. So you'll want to think long and hard about this before you start. Because it's, you know, past experience will dictate it's one of the easiest ways to get in trouble, so to speak, is to overlook these fine details.
Well, Gene, I think, is there a wrap-up, or do we go right into questions here? I think we're ready for the questions, and
We've got a bunch of questions and comments that have come in throughout the last few sections. I'm going to start reading them off, but participants can continue to submit them as we're asking through these questions. The first one that I'm going to bring up was a comment when you were going through the different tools and sort of the priorities when responding to a site. One of our participants commented that they were surprised to hear that containment isn't a high priority for response. They went on to also say that it's probably dependent on the situation and how successful you can be at keeping that oil from migrating. But perhaps you could revisit the concept of exactly what the first or top priorities are when you're responding to an oil spill.
Yeah, thanks. This is Greg, and I appreciate that. I guess I didn't mean to say that containment wasn't important. But what I was trying to emphasize was that once it's gotten away from you, now containment is extremely important if you can contain it at the spill site. If you've got a tank truck that's discharging from the bank, you'll want to have robust several layers of containment around that, because if you can contain it at the spill site, it's concentrated, it's easy to recover, it hasn't dispersed into the water column, and yeah, certainly that's a priority. I guess what I was saying, if it's going downstream, you need to realize that your success of capturing a high percentage of that oil is pretty low, and that your priority might instead be on protecting sensitive environments, protecting water intakes, before you consider containment. And the further downstream that material gets, the more dispersed it is, the more it has evaporated, the more it's dissolved into the water column, and the more difficult it's going to be to capture. We've heard the term TV boom or show boom, where we're expected to initiate containment sometimes when we know that it's not going to be very successful, just because that's what the public expects, and that happens. I guess what I was trying to emphasize was that if it's gotten away from the source, your likelihood of capturing a whole lot of it is going to be pretty low, and you should be thinking in terms of priorities, protection first.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, Greg.
Okay. We do have a few participants who have asked about wildlife issues. The first question asks, what are major wildlife management implications at the time of conducting containment or recovery activities?
Well, this is Jim. I'll throw one out. Certainly, to have the authority to respond, we've got to have oil in the water or threatening to get in the water. That happens to be where the migratory waterfowl like to go, too. So it's not at all uncommon to have migratory waterfowl impacts, in oil spills. Similarly, there's lots of animals in and around the water that are impacted. Beavers or weasels or all the amphibians and the reptiles, the turtles and snakes and so forth that live in the stream. So they're direct impacts, and usually, very often, they're fatal.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better, Jim. It's the entire ecosystem that people are concerned with, and there are seasonal components associated with that could heighten the criticality, be it migratory behavior, breeding behavior, egg laying, the consumption of fish and wildlife, vis-a-vis hunters or fishers and the like. So it's just the totality of the ecosystem in one way or the other will come into play.
Okay, we have another participant that also chimed in a bit about wildlife, but from a slightly different perspective. This participant mentions that wildlife carcasses are evidence for both law enforcement and damage assessment purposes. They will typically require special handling, and you should coordinate with local resources like FWS and NOAA. This issue may be addressed in your area plan or local response plans.
Great comment.
That's perfect.
Yeah, we agree. EPA has its own criminal division, as does Fish and Wildlife and the like. And at least within EPA, our agents are oftentimes privy to the same type of reports that we receive and will often call us in advance and just to start the dialogue. And then also, to some lesser or greater extent, we have had training, internal training, with respect to appreciating the evidentiary needs of not only ourselves but other agencies, but also to be cautious in our approach and to be mindful of other things that might be out there from a law enforcement perspective that we also need to know.
Okay. We do have a participant who wants to know if they work with EPA regional biologists or ecological risk assessors, or if they're just working with the trustee reps.
We work more so internally. Well, I shouldn't say more so, but we work both with internal or external resources. And an example of that is how clean is clean. That's one of the more contentious issues that's out there. And so in order to better prepare myself in a couple of past instances, I would speak with regional ecological risk assessors in order to better understand what the alternatives are that are available to me, not only to be able to better understand the landscape, to know what my options are with respect to contaminant cesium. There was a lot of concern about what is the final cleanup level for cesium, and I got on the phone with one of our regional ecologists, and we came up with a stuff-the-duck model. And in essence, we knew what the concentration of cesium was. We knew what its overall concentration was in water, and as a result, we knew how much water a duck could typically take in order to realize an adverse effect of the cesium, and instead concluded that the duck will have long since died from taking in all the water before it would the cesium. So that was one of the ways that they get involved with us in order to better understand and appreciate those types of issues, as well as the criticality of the resource overall, the timing of the season, migratory behavior, and the likes.
Yeah, the other comment I would make on that is that coordination with the resource trustees is one of the places in the NCP where it says the OSC shall. It's not if you want to, it's a requirement. And so that's a step that's done anyway, and it's not done in lieu of coordination with EPA people, but it's often done with them because, or at least initially because there's a requirement to do so.
Well said, Jim. Thank you.
We also have a participant who's added in a comment to make sure that you remember trustees have the authority under CWA to assess damages to natural resources. They go on to question why OSCs would be engaging internal risk assessors.
Well, I guess evaluating, there's two processes here, and he's correct. We don't do natural resource damage assessment. But we talked about yesterday, sometimes the line, we need to evaluate risk and prioritize risk in order to determine what are appropriate response actions and direct our response actions. And a lot of times that involves consultation with the resource trustees to understand what the sensitive areas are and what ought to be done and consult with them. That's not the same as natural resource damage assessment, but sometimes the line is blurred.
Yeah, and also from a practical perspective, there are many instances where the trustees choose not to engage because the incident's not big enough, or they've got other competing demands and the like.
Or it's on Christmas Day, or
right. We've had another participant chiming in that a lot of times trustees do not have experience in or expertise in risk assessment or toxicology, so they actually rely on EPA for that type of knowledge.
Absolutely, and you know, it's a tool. It's one of many tools that we can take advantage of on the ground to fashion our response. And we will take information from anywhere. I don't care if it's a federal trustee or a state trustee or an interest group or something. If there's something that someone can bring to the table to help us better understand what's going on and to fashion our response in a more effective and efficient way, you bet we'll go after it.
Okay. This is actually bringing up so many comments from the participants. We have people chiming in about what they do in their region, and one participant mentions that EPA biologists are available for internal consultation, including for risk assessment. They say that a lot of regions have interagency teams, which include EPA, FWS, and NOAA biologists that will all work together for these incidences. So,
yes, and in fact, within Region 10, a number of years ago, we were at the forefront of developing and teaching a scientific support coordinator course for the nation as a whole, and several of our senior risk assessors, ecological risk assessors, participated in that training, which it's unique in that they now have their ecological training that's buttressed by their training within the ICS and how they can better understand and appreciate their roles. But that's true. And then there's also within the ICS structure, there's opportunities for support and other types of integration of resources to come into the system and play.
Right. Well, let's move on to a new topic. We have one participant that wants to know if wood sawdust has been used at a spill site in an effective way. Did it actually work for containment and then ultimate removal of an oil spill?
Yeah, this is Greg. I don't know if containment so much as absorbent. And I've seen it used when we haven't had anything else, you know, as a last resort. Like Jim mentioned about straw, the problem with sawdust is that if it's loose, you know, you've got to pick all that up. If it absorbs, and it does a good job of absorbing oil, if it absorbs oil and then remains out in the environment, it's going to become a source itself of continued sheen for a long period of time. So you've got to be able to pick it up, and it's going to be a mess, and it's going to be heavy, and you've got disposal issues.
Begin with a good ending in mind, right, Greg?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's go on to another comment. One of our participants just brought up the idea that when you're looking at in-situ burning, you need to be sure to follow the regional contingency plan and what it says there. Can you guys comment on those types of situations?
Yeah, that's exactly true. Maybe I didn't emphasize that enough because we were starting to run short on time. But in-situ burning is usually addressed in area contingency plans. I know in Region 10 we have a protocol and a decision tree. And there's a number of people, including trustees, that think it should maybe ought to be considered more often, that it sometimes is the best option for the environment.
Agreed.
Okay. We have hit 4 p.m. I'm going to take one more question online, and then we'll go ahead and move on with some of the closing statements. I think we're going to run just about 3 or 4 minutes over our scheduled end time. So I appreciate everybody's patience to hang tight and wait till we get to the official closeout so you can get the complete details on how to share feedback, get recordings, as well as earn a training certificate for today's session. So the last question is actually asking about training opportunities. One of our participants would like to know if there's EPA training on ESA Section 7 consultations. They're concerned that there doesn't seem to be a consistent understanding of their role in the ESA process across the country, and that some of the OSCs in their region have experience with Section 7, and they're looking for training from FWS, but they just haven't found it.
Well, I'll take a stab at this. The training that we have, training opportunities within Region 10 to address this type of issue, whether it be Section 7 consultation or the Historic Preservation Act, but generally those are limited to maybe 30 minutes or an hour or so within any given year, and it's largely a refresher. I am not aware of any internal course that might be a day or 2 days in length. In order to get that level of training, I suspect people would have to go to Fish and Wildlife or other agencies who have this as one of their primary roles. But otherwise, I'm not aware of such an extensive program in EPA, whether it's regional specific, and it may be responsive to, you know, the region's needs for any particular type of training. We also have certain OSCs that are designated as the lead for those topics. So when we provide instruction on, let's say, the I think it's a memorandum of agreement with Fish and Wildlife for emergency consultation regarding oil incidents. We have certain OSCs that are pegged for being the ones to stay on top of that and to share information.
Colonel, feel free to move on to the next slide.
All right, summary statement. Yay. Been a long 2 days. Well, first of all, on behalf of myself and others, we would like to express our sincere appreciation and gratitude for the interest that's been shown in this course, as evidenced by people from many and varied levels of government within the United States, but also our international partners who have taken advantage of this. We've done our best to give you what we could at an overview, 50 or 60,000 feet, maybe even more. Ideally, this course is something that would be best taught over the course of perhaps 5 days. And so we hope that you take what we've provided, make it your own, and we wish you well. Greg, Jim, would you like to add something as well in closing?
No, thank you very much. We've enjoyed it and hope to see you soon in another one of these webcasts.
That's a shameless plug.
I like it.
Greg?
Well,
it's been swell. Thanks.
Okay.
Jean, I think you now have the mic.
Excellent. Thank you so very much, gentlemen. I've shared a couple of links in the Q&A window with our participants today. I just wanted to confirm that you can submit feedback for today's webinar using the URL I shared. It's also available under related URLs. And it's also going to be something that you'll be required to do if you're going to request a training certificate. For those of you that are participating and looking to track or earn credit for today, you can reach out to Austin from Tetra Tech, and her information will also be emailed out to everyone after today's live delivery, and request a training certificate. Austin will go back and look at our participation roster and make sure that you completed feedback after the live delivery, and if you've met those criteria, she can send you a training certificate for your own records. The other thing I want to point out is that you may find that you want to take a look at the seminar homepage to download the presentation materials or information about the course. Occasionally, accrediting institutions who are tracking training may need those additional materials to confirm if you can actually earn credit for whatever program you're in for today's seminar. You'll find all of those materials from the seminar homepage or on the additional resources site as shown on this slide. As I mentioned, the feedback form is live and available. You can submit feedback at any point in time. Even those of you who are watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you too can follow the links to the feedback form and share your thoughts. One thing I would encourage you to do when you're filling out that form, make sure you check the box that asks for a confirmation email to be sent. And that email will at least be something else you can hang on to confirm that you did share feedback with us after the live delivery. If you're looking for follow-up questions or you found that some of your comments or ideas were not addressed live during today's webinar, you can find contact information for all of our presenters on the seminar homepage. And you're certainly welcome to reach out to the instructors after today's live delivery. I will talk about a shameless plug, and that's how you can stay connected with Clewin. We do offer internet seminars like this several times per week, and we're always looking for new ideas, new requests, and ways to improve our sessions. So if you're interested in learning more about what we have and what we offer on the Cleanup Information Network, check out our websites, but you can also follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter. And with that, I just want to go ahead and echo my thanks to the organizers from a number of regions here who were able to join us. Gentlemen, you did a phenomenal job. I think you condensed a lot of information and gave training to people who would not have otherwise been able to stay up to speed on these topics. I've just seen nothing but thanks and gratitude from the participants in the feedback, so I wanted to express my thanks to you as well. And a great big thanks to the over 100 individuals who joined us live for part two for today's session. As a final reminder, it was recorded. We will be sharing the recording links for today's seminar as well as part one. We'll get the whole complete thing up on the Clewin website in about 1 week, and you'll be able to refer any other coworkers or colleagues that you think will find this to be a valuable expenditure of their time. Thank you all so very much for joining us for today's live webinar. This will be the formal conclusion for today's session. Thank you, and have a great rest of your day.